History Show with Maz Duncan.
Good evening and welcome to the History Show on RTE Radio 1. On this week's programme...
Nobody knew that anybody could remain on hunger strike longer. I think it had never been done. It had never been tested medically.
A century on, we look back at the hunger strikes in Mountjoy and Cork City jails and how these protests shaped the Republican movement. Also...
Clancy recognises the weakness of the government position, the British government position, that they didn't want to see any hunger striker die, particularly one that was unconvicted.
We look at the life and career of Father Clancy, an enigmatic revolutionary, and one of the driving forces behind the Mountjoy hunger strike. Plus...
IRA units around the country went to every tax office and either destroyed the contents, the records, or in some cases actually destroyed the buildings.
The IRA marks the fourth anniversary of the 1916 Rising by striking at the heart of civil administration here. The campaign to destroy tax records all over Ireland that unfolded across Easter weekend 1920. We begin this evening at Mountjoy Jail.
In Dublin's big town there are first-class hotels where they give board and lodgings to all those big swells. There's blinds on the windows and bells on the doors and a beautiful carpet laid out on the floor. But the grandest of all is now work in full swing. It's a beautiful building controlled by the king. I was there once myself and I'm able to tell. There's no digs in Dublin like the Mountjoy Hotel.
Mike Hanrahan there, performing Mountjoy Hotel, a song written by Irish volunteer Phil O'Neill in 1918, which gives an ironic take on the lodgings provided at that prison. 100 years ago today, on Easter Monday 1920, a core group of 36 Irish volunteer prisoners in Mountjoy pledged, quote, not to eat food or drink anything except water until all here have been given prisoner of war treatment or are released, unquote. Joined by others in the days that followed, the Irish Independent reported that by the 10th of April, the number participating had climbed to 101, the largest scale on which this form of protest had ever been attempted. And throughout the year 1920, the protest continued to spread. To talk about this, I'm joined now by Dr. William Murphy, lecturer in modern Irish history at DCU and author of the book Political Imprisonment and the Irish, 1912 to 1921. Well, you are very welcome to the History Show. Can you set the scene for us in 1920, first of all? Why were there so many Republicans in prison?
Well, Miles, very important to this is the fact that conflict had been gathering pace in Ireland, really from the late summer of 1919. Collins and his squad had begun to direct attacks against the DNP, for instance, from late August. The IRA campaign against the RIC was gathering momentum and switching from intimidation to violence. So this increased activity on the part of the IRA obviously brought a response from Dublin Castle and the British state in Ireland generally. And that led to increased numbers of arrests. Those who were being arrested were either being held for trial in Ireland, civil trial, or increasingly at this point, court martials. But also in November, the cabinet agreed to begin to use limited internment without trial again for the first time since the 1916 Rising. And small numbers of men were arrested and deported to Britain and interned without trial in Wormwood Scrubs beginning in December. And those numbers were growing through the spring of 1920.
Now, talk to us a bit about the use of the hunger strike as a tool of political protest in the years up to 1920 and then the culmination with this mass hunger strike in Mountjoy Jail in that year, in 1920.
Yeah, well, I suppose the hunger strikes in Mountjoy are part of the second great wave of hunger strikes that mark the Irish Revolutionary period. Irish nationalists themselves had borrowed, really, the tactic of hunger strike from the suffragettes who had deployed it from 1909, first in Britain and then in Ireland. And when the Irish nationalists really began to use it very effectively as a method was in the autumn of 1917. Most famously in that era, you had the Thomas Ashe hunger strike in Mountjoy, which resulted obviously in his death and the aftermath of his being forcibly fed. And there was a very big wave of hunger strikes through autumn 1917 and into the early spring of 1918, into March 1918. That wave of hunger strike led to a series of victories, really, as far as the prisoners were concerned, a whole series of releases, particularly as the state abandoned forcible feeding after Thomas Ashe's death. Eventually, in March 1918, it succeeded in bringing that wave of hunger strikes to a halt, really using a carrot and a stick. The carrot was they agreed an ameliorated regime for Defence of the Realm Act prisoners who hadn't committed a violent crime. And the stick was they effectively issued a stop or starve threat to the prisoners. So they said anyone who goes on hunger strike from now on will not be freed, they will not be forcibly fed, but they will simply be allowed to carry their strike to its logical conclusion. So that led to an end to that wave of hunger strikes, but it started to build momentum again in the autumn of 1919, when initially individual hunger strikers began to resume the tactic, and then they found that the British state seemed to have unlearned the lesson it had learned in 1918, and at first it released individual prisoners, and then there were a couple of bigger successful hunger strikes in October, for instance, 1919 in Mountjoy, when over 40 prisoners were released after a hunger strike. And so this second wave of hunger strikes begins that culminates in Mountjoy in April 1920.
And did the IRA leadership sanction the tactic of the hunger strike, or did the impetus come from within the jail itself?
The impetus really does come from among the prisoners themselves. Officially, the official IRA position is that they are against hunger strike. They issued an order in early 1919 telling their prisoners that they shouldn't hunger strike and they should instead pursue other strategies for disrupting prison regimes, like coordinated protests of sort of disobedience of the rules. They were perfectly okay with prisoners, for instance, organizing escapes. They were perfectly okay with prisoners rioting. But you know, the prisoners themselves began to drift back towards hunger strike, particularly when they saw that individuals had success with it in the autumn of 1919. And there are certainly mixed messages, I think it's fair to say, coming in from the outside. So the GHQ, General Headquarters of the IRA, are prepared to tolerate it, even to tacitly approve of it, if they think it's going to be successful, even though the official line is that it shouldn't be pursued as a strategy.
And of course, one of the leaders of the hunger strike in Mountjoy was Paddy Clancy. We're going to hear more about Clancy later in the show. But how many prisoners were on hunger strike in that strike that takes place in April of 1920? And how long did it go on for?
So the strike begins on the 5th of April and the numbers grow. So it starts with about 60 prisoners on hunger strike, but within a few days there are over 100 prisoners on hunger strike. And, you know, hunger strike is a highly communicative act. It's a great way for prisoners, if they want to, start a conversation with the prison authorities. And it's an even more effective communicative act if you have widespread support on the outside. In the first place, if there's knowledge about what you're doing on the outside, and then if pressure is being exerted by forces outside as well. And this was the case in April 1920. So Gum and the Mon are organising a significant protest outside the prison. Large crowds are beginning to gather. The Catholic hierarchy officially urges the Dublin Castle to release the prisoners, although they're not exactly sympathetic to the hunger strike as a strategy, but nonetheless they urge release. And then on the 12th of April, the Irish Labour Party and Trade Union Congress approve a general strike for the following day, the 13th of April. And that's very widely observed across at least Southern Ireland and in Dublin. And then that facilitates the gathering of very large crowds outside the prison again. So all this pressure is building up and it reaches the point where Dublin Castle begin to release some of the prisoners on the 14th of April.
Now, across the water in Wormwood Scrubs Prison in London, there's also a hunger strike. Tell us a little bit about that as well. And was it connected with Mountjoy, or was it inspired by the hunger strike in Mountjoy?
Yeah, there's a definite connection between the two. So in Wormwood Scrubs, there are sort of two hunger strikes in quick succession. There's one which is a very brief one and a very disorganised one in many ways. It lasts really 2 days on the 9th and 10th of April. So in parallel with the hunger strike in Dublin. But the prisoners are divided about whether they should strike or not. And they're particularly divided about why they're hunger striking, because they have an ameliorated internment regime in Wormwood Scrubs. So really they're striking for release, openly striking for release at this point. So that strike stops. And then when there's success in Mountjoy, when it's clear that the Mountjoy prisoners are being released, conversations open up again in Wormwood Scrubs, and there's a vote taken among the prisoners on the 18th of April, and a majority decide that they should embark upon a hunger strike. There's a significant minority who are against it. Over 60 of the prisoners are against embarking on a hunger strike, but nonetheless, the majority begin the strike. And then over time, as the strike proceeds, the moral pressure grows on the other prisoners to join the strike, and soon the numbers rise. By late April, you have over 200 prisoners on strike in Wormwood Scrubs, almost all of the cohort held there. But also, the authorities make the mistake of transferring 60 prisoners from Belfast into Wormwood Scrubs while the strike is on, and they add numbers to the strike. And eventually, in early May, again, the authorities cede ground and begin to release the prisoners from Wormwood Scrubs. They're very anxious that non-convict prisoners shouldn't die while in prison.
So these were men who were essentially convicted of no crime. So it would have been very, very prejudicial to have had them die in custody.
Absolutely. And, you know, the British are very well aware of the dire propaganda consequences of deaths on hunger strike following the reaction to the Thomas Ashe death on hunger strike in 1917, which was obviously followed by an enormous public political funeral, but also a very public inquest, which had been used as a very effective propaganda tool by Sinn Féin at that point. So there's no way that the cabinet want to see non-convict prisoners die while on hunger strike.
Are there many accounts left by the hunger strikers, by the participants in the hunger strikes, of the day-to-day details of what was going on?
The Mountjoy strike is better recorded by the participants than the Wormwood Scrubs strike. So, for instance, Frank Gallagher, who was a leading figure among the remand prisoners who participated in the Mountjoy strike, he wrote a memoir about it called Days of Fear, and he attempts to evoke the kind of atmosphere on the strike. He represents it very much as a spiritual struggle. He talks about the spiritual pride. He talks about ecstasy. He tries to evoke a kind of a hallucinatory effect that sets in after a short period on hunger strike. So it's a sort of very impressionistic and literary effort to represent the hunger strike. Todd Andrews also leaves quite a lengthy account of the Mountjoy hunger strike. He was on that, and his is much more straightforward, pragmatic, less romantic. In fact, he's quite dismissive of this idea that, you know, this is an example of a great collective effort. He stresses the fact that the moral pressure being imposed upon the prisoners was in effect an order, and that many of the prisoners were on hunger strike because they felt they had no choice. They even felt intimidated into participating.
The strikes were not allowed to continue for they ended within a relatively short space of time. So why did the government give in to the prisoners' demands so quickly?
There's a very good reason for this. They really didn't know how long someone could survive on hunger strike in the spring of 1920. At that stage, medical opinion still thought that it was very likely that the prisoner was in danger as soon as 4 or 5 days on a hunger strike. And as a consequence of that, the medical officers in the prisons generally started to recommend release quite quickly, within 4 or 5 days. The authorities then were not just under pressure from the prisoners, but they were actually under pressure from their own medical officers in many cases to effect a release. And the medical officers were well aware that hunger strikers dying under their care had significant consequences for them. Intimidation was also deployed against medical officers in Dublin, for instance, but also in Cork when hunger strikes begin there later in the summer. They're very well aware that they're likely to lose their income. Many of these medical officers are only part-time prison medical officers, and they have private practices that may go into decline if they're identified as men who have allowed hunger strikers to die. And also, they often tend to have jobs in other state institutions or local government institutions, such as workhouse hospitals or asylums, the asylums across Ireland. And those bodies are increasingly controlled by nationalist boards at this point. And the nationalist boards are likely to remove these men from their posts if they, you know, continue to administer to hunger strikers, and most certainly if they allow hunger strikers to die under their care.
Now, things seem to have changed by August of 1920 because another hunger strike begins in Cork City Jail. 11 prisoners take part, including the Lord Mayor of Cork, Terence McSweeney. McSweeney famously dies, and two others die in that hunger strike. Had British attitudes towards hunger strikers changed between April and August 1920? And if so, why?
Absolutely. So it's very clear in retrospect that the British authorities have firmly decided that they're going to return to their position of spring 1918 at this stage. And they are absolutely going to hold the line from now on. They are going to say to these prisoners, stop or starve. And they mean it this time. In retrospect, it's clear for several reasons. First of all, the authorities are becoming increasingly aware that once more prisons are becoming useless to them. If they can't stop the hunger strikes, if they can't hold prisoners, then there's very little point in deploying lots of resources in arresting and putting on trial or court-martialing men. They're also very conscious that matters have escalated in Ireland. By the summer of 1920, the violence has become much, much worse. And in July 1920, in general, the British cabinet decides to adopt a much more hardline coercive policy in Ireland. Perhaps the best indication of that increased coercive policy is the introduction of the Restoration of Order in Ireland Act in early August 1919, which gives a whole set of increased powers to the military in particular, but more generally to the authority in Ireland in the attempt to crush this rebel activity as they see it.
Now, as we hear from Maura McSweeney Brua, her father, Terence McSweeney, and the other prisoners were prepared to see the strike through to the bitter end.
He said at the time of his arrest that it was illegal. They had no right to arrest the first citizen of the city. And in any case, dead or alive, he would be free in a month. Nobody knew that anybody could remain on hunger strike longer. I think it had never been done. It had never been tested medically.
William, McSweeney didn't stay in Cork City Jail, of course. So where does he end up?
So, yes, McSweeney is arrested the day after the hunger strike begins and he immediately joins it. And then 4 days later, he is convicted. And at his trial, he, you know, insists that he will be released or he will die. He makes it clear his intention to continue his hunger strike. And at that point, he's transferred to Brixton Prison in London. So from that point on, you have two parallel hunger strikes happening, really. You have McSweeney striking in Brixton Jail in London, very close to the international press, very well-known figure. He's a figure of substance because he's the Lord Mayor of Cork and his hunger strike is achieving a lot of international attention. And then you have the parallel hunger strike in Cork, which is probably less well-known. The figures on that fluctuate over the first fortnight or so, but by late August, it settled down to 11 determined hunger strikers who are on hunger strike in Cork and are determined to pursue this hunger strike to its end.
And are any attempts made to intervene? Do the prison authorities, for example, do they try and give the prisoners food by means other than force feeding, which obviously had been disastrous in the case of Thomas Ashe?
In the case of Cork, the evidence is quite clear that they attempt briefly and I think successfully for a while to surreptitiously give the prisoners some nutrients in their water. But this stops after a period. It seems that the prisoners become aware of what is happening and therefore it stops. There is a good deal of debate about it in the context of McSweeney. Officially, at least, the authorities decide that they are not going to attempt to surreptitiously feed him. They think the danger of him recognising that this is happening are too great. Still, nonetheless, there persist rumours that it did happen. What is clear is that they inform McSweeney that when he no longer remains capable of telling them that they should not feed him, in other words, when he begins to lose consciousness, that at that point they will begin to introduce nutrients to him and they will begin to feed him. And this does happen towards the end of the hunger strike. And by all accounts, McSweeney, who's drifting in and out of consciousness, becomes aware that this is happening and it causes him quite a deal of distress during his final days.
And what's the role, what's the attitude of the Roman Catholic Church in regard to the hunger strikes?
Well, when we get to the McSweeney hunger strike, the role of the Catholic Church is quite significant. You have open public debates taking place in the pages of various theological journals between theologians who represent the hunger strike as potentially suicide, arguing that if anyone was to die while on hunger strike, that in effect they were killing themselves, and theologians who argue the opposite, that the hunger striker is like the soldier who goes into battle. He hopes he doesn't die, but he may in fact die in battle. So these kind of debates are raging in the press and in the theological journals, as I say. Perhaps more importantly, the British diplomatic service are attempting to convince the Pope to intervene, and they're lobbying at the Vatican to try and get the Pope to condemn the hunger striking in Ireland. And this sees a sort of counter campaign being launched in Rome by figures who are sympathetic towards the Irish nationalists. And that counter campaign is quite successful. They convince the Pope not to intervene. So the Pope remains neutral in the matter. Obviously, the church has a role then in the aftermath. Perhaps one of the most important elements of the hunger strikes when they end in death is the public funeral and all that surrounds that. And obviously, the church facilitates that both in London, in Southwark Cathedral, in the case of McSweeney, but also in Cork.
Yes, because Joe Murphy, who was on hunger strike in Cork, actually dies, I think, on the same day as Terence McSweeney, and just over a week before, Michael Fitzgerald had also died in Cork. Why do the deaths of Michael Fitzgerald and Joe Murphy not generate the same amount of attention as that of McSweeney to this day?
That's a very interesting question, and it's not so easy to answer. I think part of it, this is because McSweeney is, as I say, you know, the Lord Mayor of Cork. So that means that it brings a particular attention to his efforts. The other factor is that McSweeney is based in London, so that means that he attracts a lot more international press coverage. I think the fact that it's the story of the single martyr in the case of McSweeney, the personal individual story, also is attractive for journalists who are attempting to represent what's happening. And so McSweeney achieves attention. The hunger strikers in Cork really don't emerge as individuals as the strike is being conducted. They're consistently represented as a sort of group or a cohort. Now, it changes slightly when they die. So Fitzgerald is the first to die, and there's quite an amount of press coverage of Fitzgerald's death because it's the first. And there's an effort, particularly in the Irish nationalist press, to represent it as a good Christian death. There's an emphasis on the attendance of a priest at his side, his piety, he's being surrounded by his family saying prayers. Murphy is afforded far less attention. He has, in some ways, the misfortune to die on the same day as McSweeney. And McSweeney consumes all the sort of available press coverage, it seems, and Murphy's death passes almost without attention. It would be a mistake to say there's no attention, but almost without attention.
Now, the Republican leadership obviously achieved a fantastic coup, tragic but fantastic coup, because of the death of McSweeney and slightly less so Fitzgerald and Murphy. But after all of this has played out, what is the attitude of the Republican leadership towards the hunger strike as a tactic?
Following McSweeney's death, I mean, they're conscious of the huge propaganda advantage that has been achieved, particularly in the international press. But they're also very conscious of the high cost. And they're deeply sceptical that the same propaganda advantage can be achieved, a second time, that the achievements can be repeated. And so they firmly return to discouraging hunger strike in the aftermath of the deaths of McSweeney, Murphy and Fitzgerald. And the prison cohorts are far less likely to go on hunger strike in the aftermath of those deaths. The prisoners listen to their leadership to some extent, but also I think they too are now aware that it is quite likely that they are not making a choice between short-term discomfort and release, but they're actually likely making a choice that would lead to their deaths if they embark upon hunger strikes. So hunger strikes are very infrequently used, and they tend to last for very short periods from late 1920 through to the conclusion of the Irish War of Independence. Obviously, they'll be adopted again by Republicans in later phases of conflict, including during the Civil War. But the McSweeney and the Cork hunger strikes are really, in effect, the end of hunger strike as a strategy during the War of Independence.
Clearly seen as too high a price to pay. William, thanks very much indeed for joining us. William Murphy there to talk about the hunger strikes of 1920, a series of events that mirrored the escalating conflict in Ireland, where it seemed neither side would back down, and which would in turn lead to more death and to more tragedy. After the break, I'll be joined by historian Cormac O'Corry, who'll be discussing the life of one of the driving forces behind the Mountjoy hunger strike, Pather Clancy, who, like Fitzgerald, McSweeney and Murphy, paid the ultimate price in the fight for Irish freedom.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
Welcome back to the History Show on RTE Radio 1. We've been hearing about the Mountjoy hunger strike in 1920, and the driving force behind that strike was Paddy Clancy. He, along with Dick McKee, was a prominent figure in the Dublin Brigade of the IRA, and the killing of Clancy and McKee on Bloody Sunday 1920 had a huge personal impact on Michael Collins and other prominent rebel leaders. Historian Cormac O'Corry joins me now from his home in Galway to tell us about this enigmatic revolutionary. Cormac is co-author, along with Stefan O'Corry, of the book Paddy Clancy, Easter Rising Hero, Bloody Sunday Martyr. Cormac, you're very welcome indeed to the History Show. Could you start by telling us a little bit about Clancy's background?
Clancy was from West Clare. He was from a small village called Cranny. His father was an IRB man, and the house was an ordered meeting point for meetings of the organisation, as well as other radical groups. As an area, Cranny would have been on the more radical side of nationalist politics. It was a Pernellite stronghold. It was one of the first areas in Clare, for example, to have a Sinn Féin coming, and during the 1914 split in the Irish Volunteers, they opted for the more radical version of the Volunteers. So Clancy would have grown up in this kind of atmosphere. And as the youngest in a large family, he had no hope of inheriting the family farm. So he went to nearby Kildysert, where he qualified as a draper. Now, in Kildysert, again, Clancy involved himself in politics. He was an active member of the Gaelic League. He was also a secretary of a local common for Sinn Féin. And then after a brief period in Newcastle West, County Limerick, and in Youghal in County Cork, he moved to Dublin, where he joined the Irish Volunteers.
And how prominent did he become in the Irish Volunteers, and how quickly did that rise happen?
He must have been well trusted early on, because he was involved in the Kilcool gun running, where arms were smuggled in after the Howth gun running. Now, the Howth gun running was public, but the Kilcool gun running in Wicklow was much more secretive. He really comes to prominence during the course of the Easter Rising. He was a member of the C Company, 1st Battalion of the Irish Volunteers. And during the course of the Rising, he was in charge of a barricade near the forecourts. And he distinguished himself during the Rising for his leadership ability as well as his bravery. And he was promoted to lieutenant in the field.
And then what happened to him after the surrender?
He was originally sentenced to death, but the executions were suspended, and including Clancy's, most of the executions. And he was sentenced to prison in Britain. Now, by the summer of 1917, all the Easter Rising prisoners were released. He'd got to know most of the rebel leaders during imprisonment and the like, most of the active and the senior rebel leaders that had survived. So he would have known, we say, Eamon De Valera and the likes.
So in 1917, he's released, and presumably he throws himself back into the Republican movement with a vengeance.
Clancy was extremely active in the period between the Easter Rising and his release, and then up to kind of 1919 and 20, in every aspect of the Republican movement. A bit like Collins, he didn't necessarily have to stick to his own job within the Volunteers. So he involved himself in the electoral campaigns, but also as well in things like smuggling arms, stealing, buying arms, jailbreaks, clashes with the Crown Forces, attacks on the Crown Forces, all these kind of things.
Now, it's probably unfair to both men, but it's almost like you cannot mention Paddy Clancy without mentioning Dick McKee. At what point did they get together, and how closely associated were they?
It's hard to establish a point where they actually met each other first. I mean, they were both in different battalions and they were imprisoned separately after the Rising. But they certainly became extremely close. And when you're reading accounts written by volunteers of that period, veterans of that period, whatever McKee is mentioned, Clancy is generally mentioned as well. By 1920, they're constantly involved with each other in the Republican movement. They're at each other's sides, and McKee is the commandant of the Dublin Brigade and Clancy is the vice commandant.
Now, in terms of Clancy's military career, he is compared in many respects to Collins, both I think in terms of his personality, in terms of his charisma. Would that be fair? Would that be accurate?
Clancy was an extremely charismatic individual. He could be extremely considerate when dealing with people under his command. He was hardworking. He was very committed to the cause. Now, one of the characteristics that both himself and Collins shared was that they were willing to bend the rules to accommodate, we say, the more radical members of the Volunteers. You know, fellas like Dan Breen and Sean Tracy, who were pushing the boundaries, who were taking the war to the British as they saw it. But this wasn't always done with the support of IRA General Headquarters. This wasn't always done with the support of their own leadership. So Clancy and Collins and others were on that radical side of the movement. And naturally enough, they were popular with like-minded individuals.
And how did Clancy end up in Mountjoy Jail?
Violence was increasing in Dublin, particularly from the summer of 1919 onward. And the British forces, the British government and Dublin Castle, they tried to clamp down the Republican movement and pursue it maybe a bit more aggressively than they had before then. As part of a general roundup of active Republicans and the like, Clancy was arrested in March of 1920 and he was brought to Mountjoy. Now, Mountjoy would have held convicted and untried Republican prisoners.
Now, we heard earlier in the programme about the Mountjoy hunger strike. Tell us about Clancy's role in that strike.
Clancy was one of three elected leaders that the unconvicted prisoners had in Mountjoy. But it's really, it's Clancy who comes to dominate the hunger strike. He presses the issue. The issue starts off as a hunger strike about political status, but Clancy recognises the weakness of the government position, the British government position, that they didn't want to see any hunger striker die, particularly one that was unconvicted. And he recognised this, and he just basically refused any concessions that the British authorities might offer, the prison authorities. So it ultimately became a hunger strike that led to the release of both unconvicted and convicted prisoners, rather than merely achieving the original goal of prisoner of war status. And that was basically down to Clancy recognising that the British desperately needed a compromise and refusing it to give it to them.
Now, I think he demonstrated his ruthlessness in relation to a member of the Dublin Metropolitan Police, a man called Kells. What happened there?
The Dublin Metropolitan Police, the G Division, many of the most active members had been shot by Collins' squad by the spring of 1920. Dublin Castle was in trouble in terms of getting information about Republicans. And what happened then was that Henry Kells, a policeman who was just a regular policeman who wasn't a detective, he was brought into Mountjoy Jail in order to identify Republican prisoners. So the Republican prisoners, a number of them were brought onto the yard, and Clancy recognised Kells and he recognised what was happening, the significance of Kells being in the prison. So he called out to him, he said, Kells, so this is the work you're on, look out. And then sometime afterwards, Michael Collins sent in a note into Clancy in the prison with, "I'm going to Kells tomorrow," signed MC, written on it. And Kells was shot the following morning.
Now, we know the outcome of the Mountjoy hunger strike. The prisoners were released. So tell us about the arrest of McKee and Clancy on the eve of Bloody Sunday, the 21st of November 1920.
Clancy and McKee were both involved in the planning of Bloody Sunday. And on Saturday night, most of the Republican leadership who'd been involved in the planning of Bloody Sunday met at Vaughan's Hotel. Just before a raid by the auxiliaries and by the Crown Forces, Clancy and McKee left and they went to a safe house nearby belonging to a family called Fitzpatrick. Shortly afterwards, the house was raided. Now, Clancy had actually arrived at the house before McKee. McKee came in and felt that he'd been followed and he wasn't sure if they should leave. And they discussed it and they decided to stay and brazen it out, because if you're caught in the streets after curfew and you weren't a member of the Crown Forces, you were essentially admitting that you were up to something. So they destroyed a list of names of the people that were to be shot in the following morning and some other papers. And, you know, shortly afterwards, the house was raided. McKee and Clancy and Sean Fitzpatrick, the house owner, they were all brought down to Dublin Castle.
Now, despite their arrest, the operation obviously went ahead infamously as planned, and Collins's men assassinated a number of British intelligence agents across Dublin City. The aftermath was horrific, not just for the citizens who were shot at Croke Park by the Crown Forces, but also for McKee and Clancy. What happened on the night of Bloody Sunday?
The British weren't fully sure of the significance of Clancy or McKee, but they knew that they caught two big fish and they were happy with their lot. But then the minute the information started filtering through about what happened at 9 o'clock that morning, where the intelligence agents had been shot, the atmosphere began to change and it increasingly got worse during the course of the day. Now, there was a large number of prisoners in Dublin Castle, but ultimately it ended up with McKee, Clancy and another Clare man called Conor Clune, who was arrested in Vaughan's Hotel. They were left in the guard room of Dublin Castle and they were killed while in custody. Now, Clune more than likely wasn't involved in the volunteers at all, or even if he was, it wasn't at any significant level. Now, the British released a statement implying that the men tried to escape, but they never explained why the three men felt the need to escape unless they felt they were more in danger, because essentially at the time, if you tried to escape, you were running into a machine gun post and it was, you know, kind of a suicidal venture to try and escape. There's contradictory evidence about what exactly happened to them. But essentially, the gist of it was that McKee seems to have borne the worst of it and was defiant, apparently, to the end. Now, that's based on information from people who saw the bodies, but also some of Collins's agents within Dublin Castle. Clancy seems to have been finished off probably quickly enough. He was shot to the head, and Clune was obviously killed as well. Now, the British obviously maintained to the end that three men had been shot while trying to escape, but Republicans really disbelieved that completely.
In the aftermath of the Bloody Sunday assassinations and the subsequent Crown Force retaliation at Croke Park, Michael Collins's agent and Dublin Metropolitan Police spy David Nelligan was pressed into service. He was ordered to see if he could locate the two leading Dublin IRA commanders, Dick McKee and Pather Clancy, who had been captured. In this extract from Nelligan's witness statement, he describes what he discovered.
I did not know them personally, but when I went to the Bridewell, I saw no one answering to the description given to me. I called by appointment to St. Michael's and John's Church in Exchange Street, where Frank Thornton had 12 men waiting to rescue them, and I told them they were not in the Bridewell. That meant that the prisoners were in the castle, in the custody of the auxiliaries, and as good as dead. A fantastic story of an escape by these two men was put out later by the castle authorities is an excuse for murdering them. Actually, McKee, Clancy and Clune had been murdered by the auxiliaries as a reprisal in the guard room in Exchange Court, next door to and inside the castle gate. Collins was extremely upset over the disappearance of McKee and Clancy and wanted them rescued at all costs.
The words there of David Nelligan, the famous spy in the castle. The Dublin IRA leader Frank Thornton, who knew both men very well, was involved in getting the remains of the two men, and here he recalls what he saw.
I was at the postmortem. We got the bodies handed over to us. McKee was ripped from there to there and from here to here, right down with bayonets. Just ripped every rib in his body and every bone in his body was broken. And it struck us at the time when we looked at Clancy that it would look as if McKee was standing in front of Clancy trying to save him or safeguard him. Because Clancy was shot there, one wound, a gun straight up to the head and blew the head out.
Cormac, what impact then did the deaths of McKee and Clancy have on the Republican movement, particularly in Dublin?
On a personal level, the deaths of McKee and Clancy had a massive impact on Collins and the men around him. Liam Tobin said, for example, that it knocked the gut out of Bloody Sunday for them, that it kind of counteracted the military impact of the shooting of the intelligence officers, for example. Collins himself took awful chances to try and pay his respect to McKee and Clancy, you know, dressing them in volunteer uniform and being seen at the funeral and the graveside and the likes of that. I think it took him a long time to overcome it. It hardened hearts in Dublin as well from the Republican perspective. And, you know, it drove a desire for revenge within IRA men.
And Cormac, why do you think these two men are not as prominent in folk memory, in historical memory, as other leading Republicans during the War of Independence? I mean, you wrote the first book on Pather Clancy. There isn't a book on Dick McKee that I'm aware of. So why are they not better known?
I think there's a couple of reasons, really. Firstly, we say the month before Bloody Sunday, the month afterward, there was an awful lot of major events that occurred that overshadowed the deaths of McKee or Clancy. If that happened another time in the conflict, they would have been more prominently known, I think, not just Bloody Sunday, but the Kilmichael ambush, the burning of Cork City, the killing of Father Griffin in Galway, the death of Terence McSweeney, the hanging of Kevin Barry, and all these things, I think, possibly took away from the impact of McKee and Clancy's deaths in the general public. As a secret army, maybe there wasn't as much information, there weren't maybe as well known outside reasonably small group of men in Dublin as they would have been had they been also involved in politics as being TDs or something as well. And, you know, we say that probably the death of Collins as well in 1922 removed the leader that they were closest to.
Well, Cormac, you've certainly done your part in bringing the story of Pather Clancy to light. Will you tell us a little bit about the Pather Clancy Festival?
Yeah, it's an annual festival in Cranny and Cumeen, that area of West Clare, Pather Clancy's home place. And it combines family with sporting and cultural events. Now, the goal will be on the weekend of the 70th of July this year that there will be a historical debate about Clancy's significance in the War of Independence. For anybody who's interested in further information, there's a Facebook page called the Pather Clancy Festival.
Well, of course, this is an important centenary year for Pather Clancy, so let's hope the festival does go ahead in Cranny, either in July or later in the year. Cormac, many thanks for joining us on the History Show this evening. April 1920 was dominated by the Mountjoy hunger strike, but that was not the only event to make the headlines. Liz Gillis will join me after the break to talk about what the IRA planned to commemorate the fourth anniversary of the Easter Rising in 1920.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
Welcome back to the History Show on RTE Radio 1. Here are just a few of the headlines that featured in Irish newspapers in early April of 1920. Easter Rising myths, barricades around Dublin, bonfires of Easter Eve, and enormous claims for compensation. I'm joined now by historian and author Liz Gillis to tell us about the dramatic events that unfolded across Ireland on the 3rd and 4th of April, Easter weekend, 1920. Liz, just in general terms, tell us what did happen that weekend.
Well, basically, the IRA undertook a massive operation right across the country in which they destroyed the records of pretty much every income tax office in Ireland. The IRA's campaign was to make the country ungovernable. And what better way to do that than to attack right at the heart of the British civil administration by destroying all the tax records? Because, as we know, government needs money to function. And if this was successful, this would cause a huge financial loss to the Exchequer and then also disrupt the collection methods. So it would cause huge, huge disruption, and it involved every brigade of the IRA throughout the country.
And did the British have any inkling, any intelligence at all about what was planned?
They had a suspicion that something might happen. They actually thought it was going to be another rising, which is what they suspected every year since the Easter Rising. And when you look at Dublin at the time, for that weekend, they put a ring of steel around Dublin, around Galway. And you have like photographs of the military standing at barbed wire barricades. There's actually a great photograph from the Daily Sketch on the 5th of April where it shows a man being searched by six soldiers at a barricade. And the headline reads, "Dublin's latest terror." And the caption states that, "As a precaution against an armed rising like that which took place in Easter week 1916, Dublin was surrounded by troops and nobody was allowed to pass without being searched. Notwithstanding the measures taken, several income tax offices were burnt down."
So give us some of the details. What happened around the country that weekend?
Every battalion commander or brigade commandant were told to destroy the records of tax offices in their area. Now, they did say specifically that it was only the tax records that were to be destroyed. No other documents were to be taken or destroyed or money touched. On Holy Saturday night, from about 7 o'clock onwards, that's exactly what happened. IRA units around the country went to every tax office in their area and either destroyed the contents, the records, or in some cases actually destroyed the buildings.
Now, some of the buildings are quite interesting because you think of government offices, you think of government buildings, but that wasn't the case in all of the instances here.
No, a lot of the offices were actually people's houses. The tax collectors kept the documents in their homes. So that's also why it was stipulated that there was only those records were to be targeted, and also that no one was to get injured. They were ordered that no one was to be injured in this operation.
And did that happen? Were they successful in that part of the operation?
They actually were. Now, in some cases, you had members of staff were tied up. There was a caretaker. They used chloroform on him. But there was no real violence used against the tax collectors and the staff. You actually have a quote from the Connacht Tribune newspaper on the 10th of April, and it said that no shots were fired, the collectors were treated with courtesy, and while the military forces awaited rebellion, the dramatic coup was carried out with remarkable precision and regularity, the comprehensive plan apparently working without a hitch.
And in a couple of instances, I think in Tullamore and in Gorey, the IRA displayed very good manners indeed, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. Again, the newspaper reports are fantastic about this. In Tullamore, the keys of the offices were taken by armed men, but they were subsequently returned with apologies. And then in Gorey, before the men left, they apologised to the tax collector, Mr. Eugene O'Connor, and his wife for any annoyance that they might have caused them, and, quote, "hope to meet them later under another form of government."
What's probably more celebrated, but perhaps not quite as significant, is that weekend the IRA didn't just target income tax offices, did they?
No, on that same order, they also told the local IRA units to destroy the evacuated RIC barracks around the country.
Now, these barracks had been evacuated earlier in the year, hadn't they? They were, by and large, they were empty at this stage.
Yes, they were. With the evacuation of the smaller barracks around the country due to the attacks on the barracks by the IRA, it left large tracts of the country in the hands of the IRA. So to bulk up the numbers, you have the recruitment of the Black and Tans. They had begun to arrive in March. And so it was feared that then those barracks could be reoccupied. So to stop that, the order was given, destroy them. And that's exactly what happened.
Give us a sense of the scale of that operation.
It was huge. In that night alone, the figures given were that 218 barracks were destroyed in that operation. Now, that did continue because they continued to attack the barracks. And in the coming months, it rose to over 300 barracks were pretty much taken out.
And they were hugely successful, but not in Enniscorthy. What happened in Enniscorthy?
Yeah, there's only two instances where the IRA didn't destroy the tax records. In Enniscorthy, they got into the house of the tax collector. It was a Mr. Owens, and three masked men knocked at the door and pushed their way into the house. But he and his sister managed to stop them. A scuffle broke out and they pushed the three IRA men back out onto the road. But at that stage, a military patrol or a police patrol was coming on scene. So the three men got away. So they prevented those records being destroyed thanks to the quick thinking of Mr. Owens.
Now, one of the main aims was to cause a huge financial loss to the British Exchequer. Do we know what the figures were like? What did it cost the British Exchequer?
Oh, it was huge. It was massive. I have some figures that were reported in the Irish Independent for the claims that were put in for the loss of the records and the RIC barracks. And just to give you an example, in Tralee, there was a claim put in for £160,000. Dublin, £33,000. Kilkenny, £28,030. Leitrim, £20,826. Limerick, £60,000. And then Galway was £300,000. And the reason that's so high is because they did destroy an actual building.
What impact did the operation then have on the British administration, on the ongoing British administration?
Well, it did have a huge effect because the IRA had shown that the country was pretty much ungovernable. In terms of money lost, the government had to find another way now to raise money, and that was mainly through customs and excise. With the attacks on the barracks, the IRA secured their control over large parts of the country, and we know that the intelligence system was defunct, and that also was proven that weekend because they thought like an insurrection was going to happen when they'd no idea of what actually was going to take place. And they realised that, and you see then they respond by doing a complete overhaul of their administration from May onwards.
And there's always room for a bit of scandal, because amid all the claims being submitted, there was a scandal discovered where a claim was put in for an exorbitant amount of money. Tell us about that claim.
It's blazoned over the newspapers. I don't think they really wanted this to be discovered, but Inland Revenue put in a claim for 320,000. Now, Galway had put in the claim for 300,000. That was a building, you know, that had been destroyed. But this claim was put in to cover the cost of retrieving the information that was lost and getting all the necessary stationery, the books and ledgers and everything else. But then it was discovered copies of the records were actually stored in the Custom House. And at most, it would cost £10,000 to cover the stationary costs for the whole island of Ireland.
So this is the government basically trying to pull a fast one on the Irish ratepayers.
Yeah, and trying to make them pay for it. But it was discovered.
We leave it there. Liz, a fascinating story about a very busy weekend, the weekend of the 3rd and 4th of April, Easter weekend as it was then in 1920. Liz Gillis, thanks for joining us to discuss those dramatic events of that weekend in 1920. That's all we've time for on this evening's programme. Details of all our items, as well as podcasts, are available on our website, rte.ie/historyshow. Our researcher is Liz Gillis. Our reader tonight was Malcolm Adams. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, for me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.